Good morning. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and I'd like to welcome you to today's audiocast for The Object of History. The Object of History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collections. Our focus for today is the short-handled hoe owned by the family of Cesar Chavez, the leader of the movement to unionize American agricultural workers in the 1960s and 1970s. We're joined today by two guests who will answer your questions about Chavez, farm labor, bracero workers, immigration, all sorts of good things. First is Stephen Peaty, professor of history and American studies and director of the program in ethnicity, race, and migration at Yale. Steve was raised in Sacramento and received his PhD from Stanford in 1998 and is the author of The Devil in Silicon Valley, Race, Mexican-Americans, and Northern California, and articles, on Chicano history and historiography. And especially, he's currently working on two book projects, one, The World of Cesar Chavez, which is forthcoming from Yale University Press, and Leaving California, Race from the Golden State. Our second guest today is Peter Leopold, who is chair and curator for the Division of Work and Industry at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. His research specialties include the culture of work, management practice, manufacturing technology, methods and motivations of technological change, and work imagery. He has worked on a number of projects related to the short-handled hoe and Cesar Chavez, including Bittersweet Harvest, the Bracero Program, and America on the Move, which includes a really nice section on Bracero workers and their lives. So our questions for today are from students are from around the country. And the first one, perhaps we can put to you, Stephen, and that is from Rachel in South Carolina, who'd like to know whether or not there were children who were migrant workers and whether child labor was an issue that Cesar Chavez was concerned about.
That's a great question, and I think Peter probably has a lot to say in response to that, too. The answer is yes. Child labor, family labor, was a very important part of agricultural work in the United States and in most parts of the world right up into the modern period. And, of course, in many places in the world, it continues to be. So children worked commonly in the fields of California and other parts of the West and Southwest, where Cesar Chavez was very active. Into the very recent past in large numbers. They worked alongside mothers and fathers and grandparents, aunts and uncles and friends, and for several reasons. And for one thing, families needed the money that children could help bring in. Kids contributed by working, by doing what they could in order to try to bring in a few extra dollars a month that would help families that were struggling economically to be able to afford, the basics, the food, the shelter that they needed to survive. And secondly, because families didn't have any place else to send their kids. Kids came along with families because they had to. There were no, of course, babysitting services, commonly no schools in many of these areas where workers were working because many of these were migrant workers who came through for temporary stints in a local area, and so the children weren't very well integrated oftentimes into local school districts. And so this was a real concern of Chavez and many others. He had been himself a migrant farm worker as a child and had gone to many different schools as a kid as his family pulled him around and his brothers and sisters from farm and to farm, field to field, working during the 1930s and early 1940s. And in the 1960s, when Chavez became very active on questions of civil rights and for farm workers, he was very concerned about the work that kids were doing. He knew that it kept them out of school. He knew that it oftentimes had damaging effects on their bodies to be working so hard at such a young age. And so efforts to keep children from working, to abolish child labor in rural California and other rural areas were a very important part of what Chavez worked on in the 60s and 70s.
Very good. excuse me. Peter, we have another question here that is kind of a nice broad question from Rick in San Diego, and I think that's probably something that both you and Stephen will want to comment on. And Rick just sort of wants to know if we can tell him more about the growers, about the landowners, the folks who are employing, the people who are using the short-handled hoe.
Focusing, thinking about the growers is really a good way of looking at it, that quite often when examining history, and especially a situation like this where you have exploitive work, it's easy to divide people into good and evil. And it's pretty rare that bears up under investigation. I think that most historians will agree that there are tremendous shades of gray, and then this blurry middle period areas that are by far the most interesting to understand why people do what they do. Growers, there are many different types of growers. And first, backing up a bit, we should say that in California especially, agriculture tends to be very, very large. So the notion of the yeoman farmer, the family that owns a farm and maybe has a couple people to come in and help out is relatively isolated. That farms are thousands of acres and really are corporations. That growers often don't even have farms themselves, but have contracts with others, so they become even larger. When looking at the people that are dictating the use of the short handle hoe, you have to think about the growers. You also have to think about the labor contractors and all these intermediate groups. So there are a lot of different interests and a lot of different kinds of motivation.
I think Peter's totally right on all that. I have an example of a shade of gray here, and I'll admit that I'm not exactly sure how this connects up with the short-handled hoe per se, but it's an interesting kind of story about growers or part of the history of growers that, you know, just suggests something of what a complicated story all of this really is. And that is that one of the groups of growers with whom Cesar Chavez and the Farm Worker Union had lots of fights were Japanese-American growers, agriculturalists who owned their own land in Southern California and in the Central Valley of California, who were Japanese-American. And this particular group of Japanese-American farmers who call themselves the Nisei Farmers League, Nisei being the term for second-generation Japanese-American, the Nisei Farmers League were among the most energetic opponents of farm labor unionization in the 1970s. And one of the things that this group said is that, you know, we've struggled. We as Japanese Americans, we suffered incarceration, internment during World War II, and we fought to hold on to this land. And nobody's going to tell us, nobody's going to dictate to us how to run our businesses on our soil, on our property, and that this, you know, we fought to come to the point where we are in American society, despite racism and the obstacles that we confronted, particularly during the 1940s, and it really was part of their stance in by the 1970s that the obstacles that they had faced as immigrants and children of immigrants really were critical to their efforts to fight farm labor unionization. Now, I'm not sure how those farmers, those growers, what they had to say about the short-handled hoe in particular, but that's just an example of a kind of, you know, an interesting group of growers who were pretty important during this period that deserved some attention because they were quite important.
That's a really interesting point, Steve. We've got a question from Chad in South Carolina that I think actually might help us, make that linkage between the Japanese landowners and the short-handled hoe. And that's, of course, because in one of the interview pieces on the website, Peter, you mentioned that the short-handled hoe was brought to California by Chinese or Japanese immigrants. And Chad wanted to know if you could tell us any more about that, about the introduction of the short-handled hoe and how it came to be used in the American Southwest.
The introduction of the short-handled hoe is one of these stories that's is to a great degree lost in antiquity, but many people do believe it probably came with Japanese and Chinese workers in California, and then got spread throughout the Southwest. I mean, it's curious that the short Han de Ho really is not found to any great degree in East Coast farming. A little bit, I think Stephen's found some examples in the upper Midwest in beet farming, and of course only in crops, row crops, that where cultivation is really a big kind of issue. But there are, in thinking about the short handle hoe, there are virtues and detriments to using it. Obviously, the big detriment is that it is physically debilitating, that it really causes injuries to the individuals being hunched over in the fields. In terms of positive side, there are those people that claim that one can be more accurate, that not having that long handle but having a short handle, you're closer to the piece. It's questionable whether that's true or not, but certainly something that is argued. One of the probably undeniable virtues of the short handle hoe isn't in how it's actually utilized, but is a control issue that with the short handle hoe, the bosses could tell whether the workers were indeed working or not. If you're using a long handle hoe and you're in a field, you can pretty much look like you're working and not really be working from a distance. Whereas with a short handle hoe, you'd have to be bent over, even if you weren't actually doing any cultivating work, to have the appearance of work, you'd still have to be in a very uncomfortable position. So it offers less of a chance of being able to take a break. So one of the reasons that some people pushed for the continuation of the use of the hoe was much more of an ability to control their workforce.
Very interesting. Steve, I was wondering if we could take, let's say, a snapshot of the workers in the Salinas Valley in 1955. Who are these workers? Where are they from? How long have they been here? Are they all migrant workers? Are some of them not moving around? How many of them do we think are braceros? How many of them do we think are American citizens? Those sorts of things.
Yeah. So that's a good question. I mean, I don't have, the precise numbers at my fingertips, but, in someplace like the Salinas Valley in the mid-1950s, you're talking about a mixed group of workers. First of all, the vast majority of them by the mid-1950s are of either Mexican or Mexican-American descent. I would venture to guess that, upwards of 90% are either Mexican immigrants or Mexican-American. Among the Mexican immigrants, you're talking about two different categories of workers, but I should say in advance that these are overlapping categories, and I'll tell you what I mean in a second. And those categories are braceros, the formally imported under government contract workers who are arriving from the 1942 until 1964 on this formal government program of labor importation from Mexico. And that's a large percentage of people in 1955 are bracero workers. There's also the other group of immigrants, those called undocumented workers, sometimes called illegal workers, aliens, or in the parlance of the 1950s, wetbacks. This is the derogatory term that's thrown around about Mexican undocumented immigrants in the 1950s. And that's also a large percentage of the workforce in the post-war period in places like the Salinas Valley and elsewhere. But I say these are overlapping categories because we know that many of the people who came as braceros 1 year would come as undocumented workers the next, or vice versa. And that these some people who came as braceros struggled under the terms of the bracero program. They didn't like the way that the growers were treating them, and they did what was called skipping out. They skipped out of their contract, left their workplace, and became undocumented in order to find another place to work. Under the terms of the Bracero program, a bracero was bound to one employer, and if he didn't get along with the employer, if he felt that the employer wasn't treating him well, didn't pay him what was promised, he didn't have much recourse. And so the only thing that many of them decided to do was to leave and to become undocumented. So that's one category, those the Mexican immigrants, and the others are local people. And there are lots of Mexican Americans, in particular in places like Salinas in the mid-1950s, who are local residents who are still doing farm work. You know, these are people who live in, you know, in some of the big towns and small cities of the area, the town of Salinas, and in places like Watsonville, and even in places like San Jose, and are commuting into the Salinas Valley to do work. This is a large group of people. And, you know, increasingly in the mid-1950s, those local workers are feeling threatened by the arrival of immigrant workers. The local people are feeling very strongly that immigrant Mexican workers are taking the jobs that they would take if they were allowed to take them, and that the presence of more and more workers, particularly immigrant workers in places like Salinas, is driving wages down because the growers can, you know, afford to pay less because they know that there are people in the area who will take lower wages. So it's creating some tension in places like Salinas by the mid-1950s. And that the tension is precisely because it is it's a mixed group of workers in this period.
Very good.
Steve, do you think Filipinos are going to be a big part of the Salinas Valley? I know if you go a little further north and east and in the Stockton area, asparagus growing was very extensively handled by Filipinos.
Yeah, I don't think so. Filipinos are playing a major role in the Salinas area. You're right about the Stockton area, and you see them also along the coast of California, too, during this period. So Filipinos are doing particular kinds of jobs in California. They're specializing in asparagus, and they're doing some of the other specialty crops that are being grown right along the Pacific coast, a little further north than Salinas, I think. I think you also see Filipinos in the San Mateo area, which is close, kind of between San Jose and San Francisco, but I don't think that there are too many Filipinos in the Salinas area in the 1950s.
One of the interesting things about the communities that Steve is referring to is it really is impacted heavily by the crop that you're growing. Salinas Valley is fascinating because it is so rich in such a mild climate that you can have several turns. Things like lettuce is a plant that doesn't really take terribly long to grow so that you can harvest it and then plant again. In other areas with crops like peaches, fruit trees, you only need occasional work. You need to prune the trees. You need to harvest the trees. Cotton is usually a single harvest, so you need to do some cultivation, some harvesting. So it's a different kind of manpower, which in some of the instances means that a local community that would stay in working in the farms just in that surrounding area would be less strong, and a migratory force would be easier from the grower's perspective.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, something, one or two other things about the kinds of crops being grown. You have migrant workers who are not immigrants, or they're at least not recently arrived immigrants, who are following one crop as it's coming to harvest, for example, in different places. So they'll start further south, like in the Imperial Valley, right next to the Mexican border, to harvest a crop there, say cotton or grapes, and then they'll move north when the crop comes into its own, a few weeks later in Coachella or someplace else, and then they'll move further north into the Central Valley to harvest that same crop. A few weeks after that, and then, you know, further north into the Salinas area. So these crops are really important. And by the way, the crops, I think, also determine the short-handled hoe's history. I think that the history of the short-handled hoe in a place like California develops from first sugar beets which are a really important crop that take off in the late 19th century. And sugar beets are being grown and grown by and worked by Chinese immigrants in large numbers by the 1870s and 1880s. And I think that's the evidence that Chinese were involved very early on in the short-handled hoe and perhaps imported it, was the fact that Chinese immigrants were so important to what was called thinning the crop in this period, going through and doing very careful weeding around sugar beet plants to make sure that the weeds were thinned out and allowed to grow. So the takeoff of the sugar beets in California, but in other places too, into Colorado and Minnesota and Michigan, which really take off in the late 19th century, bring with them the short-handled hoe in many places. And the other thing is the rise of other kind of specialty crops like lettuce in the late 19th century, which are also very delicate plants. Strawberries is another example. Many Japanese workers oftentimes specialize in those kinds of crops in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so you see, among Japanese immigrants in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and particularly in areas where strawberries and other delicate plants are grown, the short-handled hoe being used quite a bit.
Interesting. You know, we've got a question from Anna in Fargo, North Dakota, who wants to know, and I think it's kind of a related question, whether or not there were efforts to organize workers based on their ethnicity, or were there efforts to organize them based on what crops they worked in, or sort of what the history of organizing is before Chavez and the United Farm Workers?
Well, certainly,
Peter, maybe you could start.
Sure. I mean, if you look at labor organizing in general, organizing is quite often based along ethnic and racial and even religious lines. In that you need to create a community action. So even before you go into organizing farm work, which is very difficult in terms of labor organization, if you look at workers, apparel workers in New York in the 19th century, there's work that's being done on along ethnic lines. In the case of Cesar Chavez, actually, there are two distinct unions. There's a Filipino organizational attempt, and then Cesar Chavez is working much more with the Mexican American workers.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I'd say, just to build on what Peter said, is that I think it's consistently true over the course of at least the first half of the 20th century, the traditional labor unions, the American Federation of Labor in particular, don't care too much about farm workers. And in fact, the leaders of those organizations commonly turn up their noses at farm workers. They don't see it as their job to organize rural workers. They're focusing much more on traditional craft workers, or maybe slightly later, industrial workers in the 1930s. So to the extent that there is much farm labor organizing, that tends in the early part of the 20th century into the 1940s and 1950s to more commonly come out of, first out of, you know, what I guess you would call ethnic organizations. The 1930s, I guess I'll give you two examples. The later of the two is the 1930s does see an enormous explosion of farm labor unionization and strikes in places like California during the Depression. I think 50,000 workers go on strike in California cotton in the year 1935. And so it really is a boom of labor organizing. So a good deal of that labor organizing builds on ethnic organizations, on clubs and associations that were already vibrant parts of Mexican and Mexican American communities, of the arrival of migrants from Oklahoma, white migrants from Oklahoma and Arkansas and elsewhere. And so forth. So those really are not first labor organizations, but they kind of turn into labor organizations. That's an interesting story. And another one is earlier, around the turn of the century, in 1903, in the Southern California town of Oxnard, California, in Ventura County, Mexican-American and Japanese-American farm workers went on strike together in 1903 against the sugar beet, local sugar beet interests. And they actually petitioned to the American Federation of Labor, whose president then was a man named Samuel Gompers, to be admitted into the American Federation of Labor, in other words, the broader American labor movement. And Gompers responded that the Mexicans would be welcome, but the Japanese would not be. This was a high point in growing anti-Japanese sentiment in the United States, particularly among many white workers. And Gompers felt that the Japanese simply were not welcome as part of the American labor movement. In response, the Mexican workers said that if their Japanese brethren, fellow farm workers, could not be admitted, that they wouldn't join the American Federation of Labor either, and so that didn't end up going forward. But these are sort of interesting examples of the ways in which, you know, labor organizations and ethnic organizations worked kind of connected up and didn't connect in the years prior to the 1960s.
Interesting. Peter, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little something about the relationship between the larger labor movement and, or well, not the relationship between, but the reaction of the larger labor movement to the Bracero program itself.
Well, I think it changes over time. That's the key. The Bracero program, as you know, Sharon, starts in 1942. It's a wartime program, and it's pitched and it's understood as filling a very, very important labor need in the midst of wartime society. And so in that moment in 1942, there's little or no opposition from the labor movement to braceros. There's growing concern about the treatment of braceros as workers and what that means for the American workforce in the following years. And that, I think, concern grows by the late 1950s. The pattern of the Bracero program is that it has to be renewed and sort of renegotiated in 1947 and again in 1951 and then periodically thereafter. And so at each of those moments of renewal, of reckoning, if you will, the labor movement becomes increasingly interested. But I would say that nonetheless, there continues to be relative disinterest, actually, among kind of major segments of the labor movement. You know, as I said already, you know, many labor leaders in American society don't care much. They don't focus too much on farm workers. They think that farm workers really aren't within their mandate. Farm workers really are not organizable. There's really no relationship between farm workers and union workers anyway. The person that's kind of making the strongest arguments that indeed the labor movement needs to care about Bracero workers and needs to do something to improve the Bracero program was a man named Ernesto Galarza, who over the course of the 1950s both tried to organize Braceros into a union in the United States and wrote pamphlets and books and gave speeches in Congress and at union gatherings nationwide and in Mexico, by the way, arguing that the Bracero program needed to be abolished because it was bad for Braceros and bad for union workers. So by the early 1960s, those arguments began to take hold, and the leadership of the AFL-CIO began also to echo Galarza's arguments in calling for an end to the program.
Peter, you've got such a wonderful selection of material culture from the Bracero program and from agricultural workers generally. I'm wondering if you can talk some about the process of collecting those materials. Where do you find them? How do you get people to give material to the museum? That sort of thing.
Well, finding the kinds of artifacts that we're looking for in terms of farm labor is extraordinarily difficult because it's often very ephemeral. That things like agricultural tools don't get kept, generally are not kept, they're used up. That work clothes, again, are used until they're thrown out. And that a lot of the artifacts in general related to work are not seen as important, that people see them as utilitarian. So part of it is an education process that we have to go out, talk to folks, make them realize that work history is important, and see if they might have something tucked away in closets, something that they have retained. That I think that the there are many groups of folks that understand their history to be important and should be in museums, but with new citizens, with groups that are traditionally not as empowered, there isn't that same feeling toward a museum. So it's, to a great degree, it's an effort to get out into the field, talk to people, and make sure that they understand our interest and excitement.
Very good. You also have a wonderful selection of materials related to the United Farm Workers. I'm wondering if you have some sense about why the United Farm Workers were successful in organizing agricultural workers during the time that they were in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
Well, certainly our collection related to the United Farm Workers is reasonable. I wouldn't call it too terribly extensive. That we have some materials that relate to Cesar Chavez himself and protest material in terms of buttons and bumper stickers and things like that. But there's certainly much more to collect. I don't think that one can talk about the success of the United Farm Workers without talking about Cesar Chavez. That we have a really an unusual person, charismatic individual with tremendous vision, and he was doing his work in a time where people were motivated, clearly building upon the feelings of the 60s in terms of civil rights and extending those notions into farm work. The role of the individual in terms of the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez was very key.
Very good. Stephen, we've got a question here from Matt in Virginia, and I think it's a good one because it's a little bit hard for students to grasp. Matt simply wants to know why the Delano grape strike, the 1965 grape strike, why that lasted 5 years?
Oh, boy. That is a good question. I mean, I guess the short and pat answer, but I think probably the right one, is that growers didn't want to sign with the union, and they didn't want to agree to the terms of the demand of Chavez and the others leading the union, and they could afford to try to hold out, to try to beat the union, to try to continue without a union, precisely because they could continue to grow the crops that, the grape crops that were being struck. They could access other workers. That's really a key point. There are lots of the growers' ability to recruit workers to come and harvest the grapes over the course of the 5 years was a critical part of their ability to continue growing grapes in the face of mounting pressure from the union and from union supporters. In this period of the 1960s, the Bracero program is, of course, over, but new groups of Mexican immigrants are arriving in California, eager to take jobs in California agriculture. You've got lots of rural poverty already in California and lots of desperation, people looking for work, people willing to work on places that are being struck, even if you have members of the union who would yell at you and cast aspersions on you and your family for crossing a picket line. People are still willing to do that to feed their families, of course. You have people are coming into the state, not from Mexico, but from other parts of the United States, from Texas in particular, who are also eager to try to find farm work. And so the growers are able to, continue to find people who will work on struck farms throughout California. And the other thing is that, over the course of the late 1960s, the United Farm Workers mounts a very successful boycott, series of boycotts, but one overall against California grapes, telling consumers and grocery stores around the country not to buy California grapes, to help farm workers to achieve justice in the fields of California. Growers are managed very skillfully to in contrast urge people to buy grapes, to hide the origins of the grapes that are being sold around the country, to package them as if they look like they're coming from another place, not California, and so forth, and thereby to continue to sell their grapes in large numbers. The grape boycott hurt them deeply, but it was sort of death by a thousand cuts, if you want, as opposed to being one swift blow. It took a while for the pressure of the grape strike and the grape boycott to really force growers to the table.
And Peter, do you feel like those the gains that the United Farm Workers make in successfully finally bringing those grape growers to the table, are those sustained?
The sad thing is that they largely are not sustained. That the United Farm Workers are very successful for a moment. Interestingly, they run into as much much of a roadblock with other unions as they do with growers. Today the number of workers in the United Farm Workers has dropped significantly, and as with much of organized labor, it is not a time of great strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just, if I can throw in here, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, the 1970s was a very difficult decade for the United Farm Workers. They lost union membership in 1973 when the contract signed in 1970 came up. The growers managed to, you know, either have no union in their fields or to get this other union, the Teamsters Union, to represent their field workers instead of the United Farm Workers. And there were instances of violence throughout the 1970s in which United Farm Workers members were beaten up and killed in large numbers. Large numbers of them beaten up and a number of them killed. In opposition to the United Farm Workers' efforts. It was a very difficult decade, and I think that in place of organizing and of bringing of having large membership in the 1970s. The United Farm Workers' greatest successes in that period tended to come in the area of electoral politics, helping certain labor-friendly or Mexican-American-friendly candidates be elected to political office in that period, and also doing things like helping to ban the short-handled hoe in 1975 and galvanizing support for that effort. And so those seem to me to be many of the kind of gains, if you can call them gains, over the course of the 1970s in the absence of significant unionization.
That's a great segue.
Chavez was very interested in pesticides. Was another area where farm workers were being significantly hurt and really helped shine a light onto an area that needed help. And I think that people have begun to work with. So that the baton is passed to a degree from the union to empowering government to bring about those changes. One of the things that I think historians have been somewhat reticent to talk about is, as brilliant as Chavez is early in his career, he gets to be a little odd towards the end of his career. And as a labor leader, he loses some of his effectiveness in terms of the organization.
Very interesting. Talking about the banning of the short-handled hoe and the pesticide issue actually sort of brings us to think about those legal campaigns. And we've got a great question from Alicia in New Mexico. Just wondering, and I'm not sure which of you is probably the best to answer this, if someone can tell us a little bit more about the California Rural Legal Assistance Group and how they got involved with the effort to ban the short-handled hoe. Peter, is that something that you can help
sure.
us with?
Sure. The California Rural Legal Assistance was not a union organization. Certainly the union encouraged them, largely young lawyers trying to help poor farm workers. And one of the things that was brought to their attention, Maurice Jourdain, probably is the person most closely associated with, was the short handle hoe. He was challenged to go out in the fields and work like a farm worker with the short handle hoe and really saw for himself how debilitating it was. And really engineered a battle to end it. And just as with any legal campaign, it's not necessarily clear how to bring this about. If you look at Brown versus Board of Education, the effort to end separate education for African Americans, that a distinct campaign had to be designed. It wasn't a question of whether it was right or wrong, but you had to legally win. And in terms of winning the battle over the short handle hoe, it was largely won on a bizarre technicality, and that was that it was a dangerous implement and using the industrial laws for the state. To do that, Jourdain had to compile a lot of information about injuries used by workers that had short handle hoes versus others. So he did survey work, sending out surveys to people in other parts of the country where the short handle hoe was not used, and could compare the differences and continue to carry out his battle, and eventually won in the California Supreme Court.
Very good. It's such a fascinating story that to go along with the sort of really robust public campaign from the United Farm Workers to have that paralleled by sort of a grassroots local level effort to ban the short-handled hoe. I wonder, Steve, if you wanted to sort of wrap things up for us with maybe a comment on that effort at attracting national attention to the plight of farm workers and agricultural workers and their conditions, and the success of these various activists in doing that.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. I mean, I think that, a few things. First of all, it did not start with Cesar Chavez, and I think he would have been the first to say that. I think in many ways he was the most successful at attracting national or even international attention to rural poverty questions, other questions pressing on farm workers, in particularly in California, but also elsewhere in the United States. But the efforts began much earlier. I already said that there were major strikes in the 1930s in California, for example, and had high school students been around in the 1930s, they most certainly would have heard about those. In that period of time, they were big front page news. People talked about them a lot. They worried about them one way or the other, which way they were going to go. And so this was on people's radar in earlier periods. It falls off of people's radar, of course. It sort of appears and then it disappears. In the 1950s, I already mentioned a man named Ernesto Galarza, who's making big arguments about the Bracero program for literally 15 years. Before he actually is able to convince large numbers of Americans that they need to be really concerned about this by the early 1960s. And this is just to remind people that these things take a lot of effort and a lot of time before anything is really achieved. And then there are other people in the 1950s and the 1960s who are working on this. Small numbers of people in churches and synagogues, priests, ministers, nuns, rabbis, but also lay people who are really concerned in larger numbers about rural poverty. And this is sort of an important backdrop, because those sorts of people are sort of primed when the farm worker movement in California really takes off after 1965. They jump on the bandwagon, if you will. They provide resources. They help to get the word out. They've been waiting for this in many cases for quite a long time. And so they help really push this forward, as do young students in high schools and colleges who are really interested and excited about civil rights, as do African-American civil rights activists in the 1960s and 1970s, and others. So this is part of the story of the way the news got out, was both the back history to this and also, as Peter said earlier, the timing, the fact that this movement came along at a moment in which there were many people in American society concerned about race and racism, concerned about class and poverty, and how this all kind of came together to bring new attention to the plight of farm workers.
Great. Peter, a quick closing thought?
I think that Steve covered it really well. The one thing I might add is that the media also becomes an important vehicle. Really critical, well-known moments like Eduardo Romero's Harvest of Shame makes it accessible to people. But within California, there's some really interesting, less well-known shows that start to cast a light on this. And if you start to look at newspaper articles, that there's this public cry. So the media involvement is a very important player in the whole mix.
Very good. Well, I hope that actually we can talk a little bit more about that media of involvement next week when we'll be back to discuss the short-handled hoe some more at 10 minutes after 1 Eastern time. That would be next Friday on April 27th. And I want to thank Steve Peedy and Peter Leopold for their time and their insight today. We've had all sorts of interesting conversation about the short-handled hoe, Cesar Chavez, agricultural workers, those sorts of things. A reminder to students and teachers that you can submit questions for our guests either through the website, which is objectivehistory.org, by going to the forum page and filling out the question form, or by sending an email to teachers@objectivehistory.org. Thank you for joining us today and exploring the object of history.